and we finished the long-term care portion yesterday. We're going to start today with the Department of Human Services Assistant Commissioner Chuck Johnson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Chuck Johnson, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Madam Chair, we have 21 change pages for Children and Family Services area. As you would guess, a number of those deal with making reductions in spending and programs to address the budget deficit. We also have a couple of pages that I'll spend some time on that deal with moving us forward in the child welfare area in a relatively cost-neutral way. And I'm going to start this morning on page 25, the first page that you have in your book that deals with Children and Family Services. The first seven pages in the Children and Family Services area all deal with initiatives that we're moving forward that we believe will help to simplify or streamline administration of programs that are under our jurisdiction. These are relatively small, for the most part, proposals and relatively, I think, straightforward and non-controversial, with one exception. They are also relatively small from the perspective of the amount of money that's involved in the proposals across the seven, adding up to $100,000 of savings for the biennium. The first proposal in the simplification area on page 25 proposes to merge the Emergency General Assistance and Emergency Minnesota Supplemental Aid programs into a single program. In 2003, the EGA and EMSA programs were capped and then essentially allocated out to counties for their use to provide emergency services to adults with all children. And most of this money is used to help people with housing situations, rent, damage deposits, utility costs, and so forth. The two programs we feel, and the counties feel, it's become hard to manage the two programs separately, and given the size, it makes more sense to merge them into a single program and the similarities of the populations that are served with the two programs. There's about $7.9 million a year in the EGA program and $1.1 million in EMSA, which adds up to a total of $9 million. What this proposal would do is merge the two programs together into a single emergency program that would serve adults without children who have emergency needs. The rules would be the same in terms of the kinds of services that would be covered under the current programs. However, we would make a change that would limit eligibility to those individuals or families that have incomes below 200% of the poverty level. There currently is no income limit within the EGA or EMSA programs. There is a 200% of poverty limit within the MPIP Consolidated Fund, which provides emergency services to families with children. So this would parallel the policy we have on the children and family side. It would also give the counties a little bit more ability to manage this money and set priorities for how the dollars are used.
And so there is no savings. This is just a streamlining?
This is just a streamlining, revenue neutral.
Okay. Questions about this page? Okay, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, the next proposal on page 26 is in the child support area. This addresses how we collect arrears, that is, back owed child support from non-custodial parents. Currently, when we're using automatic wage withholding on a case and there are arrears owed on that case, we administratively, under law, automatically add on 20% to the amount that we collect for the purposes of paying back the arrears. That's important to do because we do want to pay back arrears when they're owed and get them to the family and to the kids where they should be. Where it doesn't work so well is when the order that a judge has made has already considered and included arrears in the order. And then we are administratively adding on an additional 20% to cover arrears because the law says that we have to do it anytime we're doing wage withholding and there are arrears on the case. This creates problems. It creates particularly for the non-custodial parents who come on a court with an order expecting they're going to be paying a certain amount a month and then find out once the wage withholding starts that they're actually paying more and don't understand why it is. Then creates issues for the counties in having to follow up and deal with and address those situations. This proposal would continue to add on the 20% automatically where the court order has not addressed arrears and there are arrears on the case, but But in a case where the judge has added arrears into the order, we would then not add on the automatic 20% and instead collect arrears per the order that the judge has made. There is a cost on this proposal. There are two pieces to it. In 2010, there is $170,000 for systems cost to make the adjustment for this proposal. There are also costs peak in 2011 and then fade out for some lost collections for MFIP cases.
Are there any questions about this page? I guess my only question is why you're choosing to present us with this idea at this time. I mean, you know, we don't have any money, remember? And this costs money, it looks like.
Madam Chair, this is an idea that we have moved forward in the past a couple of times and have not gotten through. Part of the reason we're moving it through is because we have packaged together a number of simplification proposals, some of which have a little bit of cost and some of which have a little bit of savings, but as a package add up to be a small net savings over the course of the biennium.
Well, if you couldn't get it through when we had money, I'm just wondering what you're thinking about now. Any other questions? Let's move on.
Madam Chair, the next proposal is on page 27. This addresses child care assistance. Currently within the child care assistance program, there is no limit on how far back we go to retroactively pay benefits to an eligible case. This particularly comes up with MFIP cases or cases on MFIP or moving to transition year. They can be eligible for child care assistance from the time that they applied for MFIP as long as they were involved in eligible work activities. But in some cases, they won't know that they were able to get child care assistance or wouldn't have applied for any number of reasons, and at some point later will come in and apply and say, I would like to get child care assistance, and then we will do back eligibility or retro eligibility all the way back to the point where they had initially become eligible. That is a program integrity problem because often the documentation that we have can be very sketchy, and trying to piece together exactly what care was provided in months, many months ago, is a challenge. And it also is a lot of work for the counties when these cases come up. They don't happen a lot, but they do happen. This proposal would limit retro eligibility to 6-month look back, which would make it easier for the counties to process and would help in terms of setting some limits on how far back we go, and results in a small savings in each year of the biennium.
So why would a person not know that they're eligible for child care?
Madam Chair, our best understanding of what happens in a lot of these cases, it's a family, friend, and neighbor situation, and they don't understand that they could get reimbursed for care if it's being provided by their mother or by a sister or something like that. It's made clear in orientations and in materials, but people often don't understand that or expect that it's possible, and therefore we end up with situations where people are eligible going back perhaps as much as a year.
Are there other questions about this page? Okay, let's go on.
Madam Chair, on page 28, this is a proposal that impacts the Diversionary Work Program and the MFIP program. In 2003, we created the Diversionary Work Program, which is essentially a front-end program for the MFIP recipients, for new applicants coming into the program, which is intended to help those who are job-ready move very quickly into work so they don't have to come on to MFIP. In 2007, we created the Family Stabilization Services, which is a program for families on MFIP that gives them a different type of services, but is really for those individuals who have significant challenges to becoming employed, in particular, are not making progress toward the work participation rate. What's happened is the way the two programs mesh together is we have some families who are on the Diversionary Work Program and on Family Stabilization Services at the same time, which doesn't make a lot of sense because the two programs are really very separate in terms of what their purpose and intent is. What this would do is essentially adjust the eligibility within the Diversionary Work Program to expand the categories we call determined unlikely to benefit in DWP. So the families who come in initially for DWP who might also be family stabilization could transition to MFIP quickly, where they could get the combination of MFIP and family stabilization services instead of getting the Diversionary Work Program. That aligns the services more consistently across the type of need that we see with different families and avoids the problems that we have now for counties trying to figure out how to deliver DWP and FSS at the same time to the same family. And it does result in a small savings in the biennium.
Are there questions about this page? Okay, thank you. We'll move on then.
Madam Chair, page 29 is a page that proposes to align the look-back periods for overpayments across MFIP, General Assistance, MSA, and the Food Stamp Program. We, in looking at some overpayment cases, realized that we have different policies across the different programs for how far we look back when we're calculating an overpayment for a case. This results when, for instance, there's been an error made on the case. We paid the family too much in benefits. We then go through a process where we recover back or collect back the benefits that have been paid in excess of what should have been paid. What happens, though, is we have different programs that look back for different time periods. This proposal would set all the time periods the same as we currently do in MFIP, which is we look back 1 year in the instance where the overpayment was the mistake that was made by us, by the county worker, by the system, and we look back 6 years in the case where the mistake was made by the client. This does not address intentional program violation or fraud, where we continue to look back all the way to the point at which the fraud or intentional violation occurred. So this only addresses situations where it's been an unintentional mistake, either on the part of the client or on the part of the county worker. This page is actually not right in terms of the dollars. This is a loss of $7,000 in revenue, so it actually would be a cost of $7,000 to the general fund in fiscal year 11, 12, and 13.
Any question about this page? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just would comment that this is one of those areas where I tend to hear concerns from constituents when this kind of thing happens. And it just strikes me that when you have someone who's living month to month, you know, on a barely a subsistence level, and a mistake occurs that isn't that person's fault, that expecting them to come up with money when most people know they don't have it is kind of unrealistic and unfair.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, some of this, particularly in the case of the food stamp program, is driven by federal law and requirements there. And as I said, we do look at it differently depending on who made the mistake, that we only look back a year in the case where the mistake has been made by the county worker. And I think of it similar to when the bank makes a mistake. You end up paying for it even though the bank is the one that made the mistake. But I understand in terms of the ability to pay that this is certainly an issue. We do, when the person remains on assistance, do it by recovery. That is by taking a small percentage out of their benefit each month to pay back the overpayment. And when possible, we try to collect for people who have left assistance, which is challenging because people often don't have a lot of money.
So are you expecting that you'll be able to get federal approval for this?
Madam Chair, we believe we can. The food stamp law would allow us to do this. Our state plan does it a different way right now, so it's really just a matter of telling them we're going to do it in the way that we say here, which is within the parameters of the federal law.
Any other questions on this page? Okay, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, the next proposal on page 30 addresses the fraud prevention investigation initiative. This is a recommendation that effective November of 2009, responsibility for FPI, the fraud prevention investigation, will be transferred from the counties to the State Department of Human Services. FPI, it was created in 1990 as a pilot, has expanded. It now operates in 55 counties. Across those 55 counties, we have 31 investigators who do about 6,500 investigations last year. This is funded with $1.5 million in a state grant. The counties are able to then get federal financial participation, so the total budget for the program annually is about $2.8 million. It's really our main effort. It is a complement to what we call fraud control, which is and will continue to be done by the counties, which is the more criminally oriented prosecuting those more egregious cases. FPI is more about trying to identify situations where there may be something suspicious about a case and catching it before it gets too far along, using civil procedures such as claims and recoveries to get the money back, and using disqualifications from programs rather than criminal prosecution as the way to essentially address the violation that has happened. What's happening with this program has happened over the last couple of years is with flat state funding, we're at a point where as county costs increase gradually each year, we're not able to continue operating the program at the same level and capacity that we have in the past. We did not cover the cost fully in 2007. And over time, either counties will have to pick up more of the cost of this, or we will have to reduce the program by pulling counties out or by pulling back the number of investigations that we're able to do. We believe that by pulling the program back to the state, that we can operate it more effectively and more efficiently and actually do more investigations than we're doing currently. Currently, in the FBI program, the average investigator does 17 investigations per month. But if you look at the distribution across the different counties that are doing it, the ones that are operating at a higher level are doing 25 to 30 investigations a month. We believe that we can get into that range by operating it at the state level, meaning we could do more investigations for the same amount of money, and that we could also ensure more consistency and common practices across the state in how we do fraud prevention investigation, and that we could direct and prioritize resources more efficiently. We would propose to have this fully have a full complement of staff on board by February of 2010. So there'd be a phase-in period that would happen during 2010 when the counties would phase out, and we would pick up this activity. We would expect that the investigators who would be employed by the department would spend most of their time out in the field working with the counties, and that we would have certainly investigators who would work outside the metro area and some that would probably be stationed permanently outside the metro area but would be department employees and under our supervision and direction. We do think it's important that we have a good relationship with the counties in delivering this program. That's a key to making FPI work. And so that would be one of the things we would really foster in how we would implement doing this from a state perspective.
And I would assume then that this proposal would include a request for more FTEs in the department?
Madam Chair, that's correct. This would be, there are 28 FTEs included in this proposal, 25 investigators, 2 supervisors, and a support staff. And it is roughly cost neutral. You can see there's a small savings in each year. Basically, we would, the $1.5 million that's currently distributed to counties would come back and be reappropriated to the department. We would also, of course, have the ability to draw the federal financial participation to be able to operate it at the same $2.8 million, roughly, that the counties are using now to operate this program.
The budget page is showing a savings.
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's a, we can do it for slightly less than the counties are doing it.
Are there questions about this page? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I'm just, have the counties been involved in this recommendation?
Madam Chair, we have talked with the county social services directors as well as the Minnesota Fraud Investigators Association about the proposal. We actually were working on this proposal last year. We did not bring it forward to the legislature, so both those parties were aware that this was something that we were looking at. Both parties are aware that we're facing a decision point with FPI because of the limited funding being capped, and that going into the future, we need to have a different way of doing this, which may result in fewer counties or fewer investigators, or as we're proposing in the state takeover. I think it would be fair to say the fraud prevention investigators do not like this proposal. I'm not sure that I could characterize for you how the social services directors feel about it. They certainly think this is an important service and would want to work with us if we had it, but I'm not sure that I have a sense of whether they've taken a formal position on it.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it likely that the people who would be hired to fill these FTEs would be people who are already state employees who maybe would be moved into these positions, or would you make an effort to hire people within counties who are doing this work now?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, we will be looking for experienced investigators. So certainly the people who are doing this work now would be prime candidates for these jobs. We would go through a hiring process, so there wouldn't be a guarantee, but certainly if those individuals were interested and they had good experience in the investigation, those would be folks that we'd want to have, not just other people who are currently within the department who may have never done investigative work. We definitely want people with investigative experience.
Any other questions about this page? Let's move on then.
Madam Chair, the next page is on page 32. This is a proposal that addresses appeals and how appeals are handled in revenue recapture cases. Under current law, if we talked earlier about overpayments, and when someone has an overpayment and we send them a letter saying we're going to collect some money back from them, someone can obviously appeal that decision that we've made. They also when someone is not paying back on an appeal, we will work with the Department of Revenue to capture tax returns and so forth through a revenue recapture process. They can also appeal that process and say, we're going to appeal, I'm going to appeal because I don't like the fact they're taking my tax return. Under current law, those two appeals go to two different places. The appeal on the overpayment goes to the Department of Human Services referees who do our appeals. The appeal on the revenue recapture goes to the Office of Administrative Hearings. That creates several problems. One is the client can be going, have to go to two appeals in two different places for essentially the same issue. The underlying law, the underlying action is all the same about why it is that we're collecting this money. Secondly, the Office of Administrative Hearings doesn't do a lot of our appeals, so they don't have a lot of experience in dealing with these kinds of issues, which creates some problems on that side. Thirdly, the counties have to pay to take a case to the Office of Administrative Hearings, which means sometimes they won't take the case there. They'll work out some kind of a settlement because they don't want to have to go through the process of taking the case through the Office of Administrative Hearings. This proposal would essentially say both pieces of this action, the overpayment and the revenue recapture, would go to the DHS appeals referees. It would be dealt with as a single issue by a single referee. That helps in the sense that our referees understand all the laws around this, are experienced with this, could do it more expeditiously. It would get rid of the issue with the county cost, which would make it so that the counties could instead bring it here and know that they would pursue more of these appeals and challenge their side of the appeal, which we think is helpful in terms of the program integrity side. The fiscal impacts on this are we need another half FTE in the appeals area to handle the additional appeals work, but that will be offset by more than the collections we would get back on handling more of these appeals and getting more recoveries out of that. We're a net reduction of $9,000 the first year and $18,000 the second.
Are there questions on this page? If not, let's move on.
Madam Chair, the next proposal is on page 34. This is net fiscally neutral. This is a proposal to capture expected underspending in the basic sliding fee child care program and direct it to the continuation of two pilot programs that would otherwise be ending in the next couple of years. Under the current basic sliding fee child care program, we have had underspending in some level or another each of the last 10 years. Those dollars, we usually know that amount. We don't know the amount right now. We usually know it sometime late February or early March exactly what the underspending is. The last couple of years, that underspending has been taken and refinanced to help with other budget issues that the state was facing. What this proposal would do, these are federal dollars, child care development fund dollars, that come from the underspending. What this proposal would do is propose to invest the expected underspending, or at least a portion of it, into two pilot programs in the early childhood area that we've started over the last couple of years that we want to be able to continue through 2011, because through 2011 is the point at which the evaluation of many early childhood initiatives in Minnesota will be coming, and the point at which we expect we'll be making some decisions as a state is how we're going to move forward in the early childhood area with the next initiatives for Minnesota. The first of these programs is School Readiness Connections. This is a program that operates within the Child Care Assistance Program. It allows us to provide, through a contract, additional resources to child care providers who are handling a concentration of low-income children and agree to meet certain quality benchmarks as part of that. So it's a way for us to direct additional money to programs that have a lot of low-income kids and are also providing, against quality standards, a good early childhood experience for those children. This was funded in the 2007 legislature, but only for 2 years. So it's sunsetting June 30th of this year under current law. This proposal would extend it for 2 more years through 2011, which would allow us to get a full evaluation of how it works, and then, as I said, to have be part of that decision-making process that we believe is going to happen in 2011 around a number of early childhood initiatives. The second piece of this is a quality rating system. Quality rating system is a foundation of building our early childhood system, we believe. It is really about how we identify where there are quality programs so the parents can make good decisions about where to send their children to get them ready for school, but also so we can be directing public money to programs that are making a difference for kids and not necessarily just any program that's out there on the street. The current pilot that we're running is called the Parent Aware Program Quality Rating System. This is currently funded through 2010, and the proposal here would be to fund it for 2011 for the reasons aforementioned, that we want to be able to have it not have to shut the program down and start it up again if we decide we want to continue it, but rather to have it be extended through so that when decisions are made about what we want to do statewide with the quality rating system, we'll have the parent aware infrastructure in place to build upon. The dollar amounts for the SRC, the School Readiness Connections, are $763,000 in the first year and $760,000 in the second. Parent Aware, as I mentioned, is only for 2011, and that's the amount of $990,000. We believe this is a good use of the one-time money that will be left from the CCDF that will drop out after the basic sliding fee underspending. That it's investing in pilots we have that are moving us toward the future where we want to go in early childhood. We do propose that if there's any remaining money from underspending and basic sliding fee after we fund these two pilots, that that would be refinanced to help with the general fund deficit.
So, Assistant Commissioner, first I just need to say that I find this budget page inadequate because you are actually are spending money. This is not a zero-cost proposal.
Madam Chair, we're spending CCDF dollars, which are statutorily appropriated, not direct appropriated. Proposing to spend.
Well, you are spending money that you expect. You're spending money on this from an area where you expect you won't spend all of your money.
No, I'm just correct.
And so this proposal does cost money. It is not a zero-cost proposal. And
Madam Chair,
while I think it's an admirable proposal, I would find it myself able to be a lot more excited about it if we weren't taking $10.3 million out of child care by giving every child care provider in the state a 3% reduction. So we're going to help two places, and everybody else is getting a cut. And that $2.5 million that this proposal costs could have been subtracted from the $10.3 million that all child care providers in the state would take as a reduction. Is that not correct?
Madam Chair, these dollars could be used for that purpose. That's correct. Although this is one-time underspending from the program, so whether it would fill that void for the longer term, I think is a different question.
Are there any other questions about this proposal? Senator Erickson Rolls.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for asking the question because I was confused at the beginning of your presentation and recall Senator Lynch's comment the other day on different terminology that this committee is being presented with. The word gleaning the other day in terms of gleaning money from different programs to come up with funding for another source, and I think this is another example of if the department underfunds one area to provide money for another, it's a curiosity to me.
Well, it's underspending. They're expecting that we've appropriated more money than is actually going to be spent to the tune of about $2.5 million. And this would take statutory language to change this appropriation. And because of that, I just think this budget page with the zeros is not really a very good way of presenting this item. Other questions? Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And also in the proposal, it says that funds remaining after these pilots will be refinanced in the child care assistance program and returned to the general fund. I mean, it appears there is a general fund effect in here, too, and it is not accounted for up in the top chart either. How much is would be refinanced and returned to the general fund.
Madam Chair and Senator Lori, as I said earlier, we don't know the exact amount of underspending yet, and so that's part of the uncertainty here is identifying exactly what that amount is, which we'll know probably in early March. We expect it'll be in the range of $5 million, but that's only an estimate at this point.
When you find that out, will you be notifying us?
Madam Chair, absolutely.
Any other questions? Let's move on then.
Madam Chair, the next page, on page 36, are the adjustments to the adoption assistance and relative custody assistance programs. As the committee is aware, the adoption assistance and relative custody assistance program operate like entitlement programs but are not forecasted programs, meaning that we have to come back every 2 years to get the funding based on our forecast of whatever we expect to happen with the utilization of the programs. This proposal includes that across the 4 years of the budget period. I would note that of the amounts in 10 and 11, that $5.1 million each of those years is not representative of the growth in these programs, but is rather the base having been underfunded in the 2007 budget. So you're looking at about $13 million in 10 and 11. About $10.2 million of that is actually base funding that was not funded in 2007. This catches up the base as well as funding the growth, which would be roughly in the range of $3 million over those 2 years. Adoption assistance is a program that provides assistance to parents who adopt children out of the child welfare system. It is a permanency program. It's vital to our efforts to help children in the child welfare system achieve permanency, get permanent families. Similar relative custody assistance is for relatives who take permanent custody of children in the child welfare system where it's not possible to return that children to their biological parents. And so there's similar programs in the sense that they provide assistance to families who are taking kids out of the child welfare system who are either have had their parental rights terminated or can't be reunified with their birth parents. Madam Chair, this proposal does interact with the next proposal I'm going to talk about as well, the proposed single benefit for permanency.
Assistant Commissioner, there was $6 million of underspending in this program over the biennium that was unallotted by the governor. In light of that, I'm just wondering why there is so much growth projected here.
Madam Chair, the forecast that you're looking at here is significantly down from the forecast that we were looking at 2 years ago or a year ago because of that underspending, because it does look like the growth in the program has slowed somewhat. But that still does result in the kind of growth pattern that we show here, even with the new trend line that we're looking at based on the underspending in the last or the current biennium.
Well, Commissioner, I would have a lot more confidence in your estimating if we hadn't given you $5.4 million in 2007 and then turned around this year and unallotted $6 million because of underspending. So I guess what I'm saying is in the past I don't think you've done a very good job of getting close to the right number here.
Madam Chair, this has been, this last 2 year period has been something of a shift in the program in terms of the pattern, and so we are trying to catch up and identify what's going on with it. We do believe that the proposal that we have here is, we're confident that that's the right direction based on the current trend line in the program.
Maybe you could get us some more information about that trend line.
Madam Chair, we could do that.
You know, we don't want to underfund this program. It's an important program, but in the past, when we haven't had money, we've been overfunding it, and we don't want to overfund it either. Are there other questions about this page? Okay, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, the next two pages represent important proposals in moving forward and making progress in the child welfare area. This is an area where we made a lot of progress over the last 10 years or so. We've done really nation-leading work in terms of alternative response and child protection. This is work that is strength-based. It's early intervention with families. It's resulting in making kids safer and saving us deep-end costs in the foster care system. We're also finding success in pilots we're doing with earlier intervention, getting out ahead for kids who have been reported for maltreatment but have not been accepted in for determination. And these are families that have the same kinds of challenges and, again, the same kind of benefits we get from those early interventions. We've also made a lot of advancement in the permanency and adoption area, special adoption efforts around adolescents and other hard-to-adopt children. But we are facing many challenges right now in the system. We have very strict federal oversight in this system, and that is going to only increase in the future. We run a strong program, we believe, in Minnesota, but we're getting a lot of oversight from the federal government, particularly in our permanency efforts and our ability to move children quickly from foster care into permanency and not having those kids languishing in long-term foster care. We also continue to deal with disproportionality and disparities within the system, particularly for African American, American Indian children in the foster care system. That's a continuing challenge we need to be addressing in conjunction with our partners in the counties. And we also have issues with the ongoing fiscal capacity of this system. This is a very heavily supported by the counties. Over 50% of the money that goes into the child welfare system is county property tax dollars. The state share is relatively small, less than 20%. Our concern is that as the counties are feeling more pressure, to what extent do we start to lose progress on some of those reforms we put in place and get focused too much back on some of the core activities that counties don't have a choice in doing? And how can we address that as best we can, given the fiscal environment that we are in as a state? We believe that if nothing changes, over the next 10 years, 90,000 kids will enter foster care. 15,000 children return to foster care because of inadequately help getting them permanent after they've been reunified. And 6,000 teens will age out of foster care in the next 10 years if we don't begin to change some of what we're doing within this system. The next two pages, the single permanency benefit, which we've called North Star Care for Children, and the restructuring of CCSA, which we're calling Protecting Children's Act, are vital pieces of trying to move forward with this. We also have some policy changes we'll be bringing through the policy side to look at how we engage fathers more in the system, which is an important measure the federal government is pushing us on, working on tribal capacity for services, and also looking at the removal standards and amending those to align with our interest in having kids in the home whenever possible. Madam Chair, on page 38 is Child Permanency and North Star Care. This proposal creates a single benefit for children who have been removed from their homes. It unifies the policy, the benefits, the rate structure, and the financing for child family foster care, adoption assistance, and relative custody assistance. This supports relative custody and adoption by removing financial disincentives that exist in the current funding system, and it streamlines the administration of the program for us in the counties. Under the current system, there are three different programs that we move kids into when they're removed from the home. Foster care, which is where kids go when they're immediately removed from the system, which includes long-term foster care, which can be a place where a child ends up even after parental rights have been terminated if they're not adopted. Adoption assistance and relative custody assistance, which I just discussed previously, which are our two permanency programs that we have in place now. When a child is removed, our first and singular focus is to try to reunify them with their parents whenever that's possible and can be done safely. We do that in about 80% of the cases. For those that don't, however, we need to have the permanency options and need to have that working so that children will have a permanent option to live in and will not end up in long-term foster care and aging out at age 18. Right now, the rates that are paid for parents in the foster care system are roughly twice the rates that are paid for parents on adoption assistance and relative custody assistance. That's a backwards incentive if your goal is to move kids to permanency. It's particularly a problem because oftentimes the foster parents themselves are the best candidates and are interested in adopting the children that they've been caring for once parental rights are terminated, but essentially they'd have to take a pay cut if they want to be the parents for these children in an ongoing fashion. What this proposal does is creates a single benefit program across, as I mentioned, the three programs that currently exist. This would be a new and simpler program to provide a continuum of care for kids who have been removed from their home. It would be driven by a single universal assessment tool, which would be the way that we identify what the needs of the children are and what supports are needed, and then drive the rates and the payments we make to families off of that. Right now, within the three programs, there are three different ways of determining what child need are. And that's very complicated. We're in process of working with the counties to develop this tool, are piloting it now. We think it'll result in a much more consistent way of identifying child need across the three programs and across the 87 counties. We'll continue to have the three different ways that the kids may come into the system through the same kind of the foster care and adoption world and the relative custody. The relative custody we're renaming guardianship. This is to align with the language in a new federal law, which over time will allow us to claim 4E federal reimbursement on guardianship placements, which we currently do not have available in a relative custody assistance program. We will also align the rates, and if you look on page 39 of your budget book, you'll see a table that lays out the current rate structure as well as the proposed rate structure for the new program. On the left-hand side, in the upper left of this box, you'll see the basic rates that we currently pay in foster care, adoption assistance, and relative custody assistance for the different age groups. And as you can see, the rates are, as I said, twice or more higher on the basic rates in foster care than what they are for relative custody and adoption assistance. There are also supplemental rates, and in foster care, there are possibly 225 different levels of supplemental rates that can be added on to that basic rate. This is driven, as I said, by an assessment that's now used in the foster care system. In RCA and adoption assistance, there are four different supplemental rates. On the right-hand side of that table, on the right-hand side of that gray bar, you can see the proposed rate structure for the North Star program, which would have the same rates across these three populations, these three programs. The basic rates, which are slightly lower for younger children and in rough alignment for older children with the basic rates in the current foster care system, but a much more limited, only 10 supplemental rates that is capped at or limited at the $600 level, less than what's currently paid in foster care. We believe that what this gives us is a consistent way of addressing kids' needs across the system, and it gives us a way of ensuring that we have discipline within the system and how we're setting these supplemental rates, which is a challenge now, particularly in the foster care area. Certainly with these rates, there will be some kids currently in the foster care system where the rates will be lower under the North Star care than under our current foster care system. On the permanency side, the rates will generally be higher for adoption assistance in RCA cases than what we currently pay. This is, as you can see from the budget page, roughly revenue-neutral way of readjusting and retooling these programs together. And that means that in some cases there are people that will get less, in some cases there are people that will get more. But we believe that this is the appropriate way to go to align the services. The financing of this program, the non-federal share would be shared between the state and the county. Currently, counties pay the non-federal share of foster care. The state pays the non-federal share of adoption assistance and relative custody assistance. This program would be effective January 1st of 11. We will be working in the interim with counties on bringing together more of the pieces of how this would work. But essentially, we'd be looking at two different pieces of the financing. One is for cases that were converted over from the existing programs, and the other would be for cases in the ongoing program who come on after January 1st of 2011. For the new cases, we create a shared state-county rate for the non-federal share, which will be based on spending through 08 to 10, and would be based on the current shares. Our estimate now is that would be about a 60-40 rate county-state. For converted cases, we'd essentially hold constant the proportions of not only state but individual county proportions of those converted cases. As that converted case that would then shrink over time, we'd hold those proportions constant. Again, we'd base that on spending in 8 through 10. This also is, this proposal is dependent on the funding of the adoption assistance, relative custody assistance forecast, what we talked about in the previous page, because those dollars would essentially be driven into this new system as part of what would support the new North Star system. This is a large and significant proposal. It would impact about 17,000 children. The current spending, non-federal spending, total spending in this area is over $100 million between the state, the county, and the feds. It would streamline and simplify, provide more consistency in how we handle children who have been removed from their homes, and we believe it would align for a better continuum of support toward permanency for children.
And I guess I think this page is a little misleading also because it isn't showing the $11 million of refinancing of TANF.
Madam Chair, the TANF effect here, under current law, relative custody assistance, when individuals apply for relative custody assistance, they are told to go apply for MFIP child only. And if they get MFIP child only, that essentially represents a portion of the payment we make to them under RCA. RCA then fills in anything above that MFIP child only benefit. In the new program, we propose to not have the MFIP interaction, but rather to pay them directly through the guardianship, in part because we'll be able to claim over time increasingly federal 4E reimbursement for those guardianship kinds of placements. That results in a savings, as you suggested, to the MFIP program. That is TANF money, and our proposal is to take that savings from the TANF and refinance it for the purposes of helping with the general fund.
Well, I am not a very big fan of TANF refinancing, so, and you know that. So, you know, one of the things that we were forced to do by the administration last year was to cut the second year of this biennium's work support program for TANF recipients. Now, is there anybody in this room who thinks next year we're not going to need work support for TANF recipients to help meet our work participation rate? Are there any other questions about this page? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Johnson, was this proposal vetted through the Children's Justice Initiative at the state level and down to the county level? Is this something that has been brought forth by those initiatives?
Madam Chair and Representative Rosen, or sorry, Senator Rosen, yes, we have had discussions with counties around this. We actually had brought in a small group of county people and walked them through very much the particulars of this before we introduced it. And we've had a meeting last week with the counties after we introduced this. And I think there's details to be worked on, and I won't represent the county position. I think people in the child welfare system, which would include many people in the counties, think this is the right direction to move. Obviously, there's fiscal issues, and people need to assess that and determine whether they think that's the right thing to do. There are concerns, I think, on the foster care side with because we're capping the supplemental benefits at a lower level than we do in the current foster care system, how will that affect recruitment of foster parents? And so that's a concern that I think we need to talk about and everybody needs to understand as we move forward with this. The Children's Justice Initiative, we did talk with the folks there about this. We have not taken it through the advisory committee in any other way. We have talked about this general direction within the advisory committee of the CJI because it's a direction that we've been talking about for a while. Looking at how we can do a better job of aligning our benefits toward permanency.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Other questions? Senator Sharon.
There is a third program for family members who care for children who do not have custody of the children. It's a kinship support program for children. This is not, they are not wrapped into this or impacted by this legislation?
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, that I believe is not included here, and that's correct. It's not included as part of this.
And follow up question. Sharon. Did you look at including them in this program as well?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I think I need help with the answer to that question.
Oh,
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, it was largely a cost issue. It would have driven up the cost of the proposal to have included them here, and so we didn't include them in this proposal.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, thank you. And to that issue, I have some very strong kinship programs in my Senate district, and they're all based off of volunteerism and volunteer dollars. Not only the participation, but the workings of that, the financial workings, are all volunteer dollars.
Any other questions about this page? Not. Let's move on.
Madam Chair, on page 41, is a proposal that we call Protecting Children Act. It also is a reconstruction of the Child and Community Services Act. This proposal, like the North Star Care, is an important part of what we want to do within the child welfare system. And in both cases, part of what we looked at in terms of the fiscal issues, financial issues within the child welfare system, is obviously there is not new money to be investing at this point. What we're trying to do with both North Star in redirecting the adoption assistance and RCA dollars and here in the redirection of the CCSA dollars is to make the best use possible of the state resources we do have in the system to ensure we get the best outcomes that we can for the kids in the system. Given that we don't have additional money, we think it's important that we make the best use we can of the dollars that we do have out there right now. This proposal creates the Protecting Children by Strengthening Safe and Stable Families Act. It takes essentially the children's services portion of what is now CCSA, which is about 55% of the funding, and redirects it to children. It's about $55 million a year. The amount is based on how much county spent out of CCSA on these activities in 2007, and this would be effective also in January of 2011. Under this fund, we would prioritize state funding to those services that we believe are most important to moving our child welfare system forward. That means support for at-risk families, support for family assessment response, and other time-limited services that come in front of traditional investigation, and also for post-permanency services, which we really don't invest a lot in right now, but is really critical to ensuring that when a child goes back to their home or is placed into a new home for permanency purposes, that we don't end up with the child back in the foster care system because the placement didn't work or the reunification didn't work. It really commits to a strong set of outcomes, and over time, we would take the formula by which we allocate these dollars to counties and make it increasingly based on performance against, in particular, federal benchmark measures, performance in safety and permanency and child well-being within the child welfare system. We would also use the planning tools within the CCSA system to address disparities and how counties are addressing disparities within their system, particularly, again, for the African American, American Indian kids, where we have the huge disproportionality right now. As part of this, because we are splitting up the CCSA, CCSA was created in 2003 by collapsing together a number of grants from different areas into a block grant that is valued at about $100 million, about $68 million of that is state dollars, and $32 million is the social services block grant from the federal government. The 55% that I've just talked about would be dedicated to the Protecting Children's Act. The other 45% would be split up between four different areas outside of the children's area where counties are currently spending money within CCSA. Aging and disability, this proposal would allocate the money across counties based on prior year's expenditures, really focus on protection of vulnerable adults and prevention for institutionalization supporting people in the community. Chemical dependency, which would allocate money out to the counties and would focus the money on use of detox services, which is right now a heavy county cost area. This would provide support in that area. The adult mental health would be granted to counties or to the mental health regional areas, really to support a lot of the initiatives that were moved forward through the mental health initiative a couple of years ago, where the counties provide that part of the infrastructure on the ground for the mental health services. Similarly, for children's mental health, the dollars would be allocated to counties. This is really about the community safety net for children with serious and emotional disturbance and ensuring that the county resources that are in that system now continue to be part of supporting that system going forward. Again, with limited dollars, what we're looking at here is trying to direct the dollars we do have to the purposes that we think are most important for the state to be investing in, rather than having the dollars going into a lump that then is driven by county priorities for spending.
Again, Assistant Commissioner, I think this budget page is somewhat lacking. I think that the actual numbers that are in the tracking should be reflected on this page, since this would be a reallocation of funding within the budget, even though it may result in a net zero change in total spending. It does result in different spending than we're doing now, and that really isn't reflected in this page at all.
Madam Chair, there are usually fiscal detail tables that are at the end of the budget change pages that for some reason got dropped out in the process, and you're absolutely correct. There is a page that I have from a previous draft that does break that out, and it is in your tracking that's at the way back of your book.
But
that'll come up in a number of other pages where it's really hard to track what's going on without the fiscal detail.
Assistant Commissioner, it is very difficult to go through this number of budget pages and continually be referring back to the tracking sheet. I mean, it's really difficult to
Madam
do that.
Madam Chair, I agree. I understand.
So maybe that extra page that belongs in here, you could get us a copy of it, and we could make a copy for everybody to put in their book?
Madam Chair, we can do that.
I think the other comment that I have about this budget page is that while it might be fine for the administration to decide what priorities should be at the county level, it would be equally important for us to know what priorities the counties have identified that get left out when we allocate the money this way.
Madam Chair, I agree, and I think that there needs to be conversations with counties around the individual pieces of this. I know that in the aging and disability area, they're proposing to work with stakeholders over the next year and bring back more detailed language next year, since this wouldn't be implemented until 2011, as a way of trying to ensure that we get input into how the dollars are best used for the purposes laid out here.
Well, what about the other areas? What about adult and children's mental health? I mean...
Madam Chair, I expect that we'll continue to have conversations with the counties around the best use and direction of those dollars.
Other questions about this budget page? Okay, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, on page 44 is a page that would recover the temporary payment that was made to counties. This was an appropriation that was made in 2007. It was $32.7 million in one-time money that was set aside to help offset what was expected to be a county loss because of federal regulations in targeted case management. This affects children and mental health and, in a lesser extent, the disability area. Federal government did issue those regulations, and we did then send the money out to the counties per the state law. But then shortly after the regulations were issued, Congress put a moratorium on the regulations. That moratorium stays in place until April 1st of this year. The stimulus bills that are floating around would extend that moratorium, I believe, for another 6 months, or maybe even a longer moratorium. And certainly the new administration is reviewing all the rules that were put in place by the last administration. So what happened is, under law, we were required to put this money out to counties, but shortly after the money went out there, the TCM door was reopened and counties have been able to continue to claim against TCM. This proposal would essentially pull back the $32.7 million that we allocated out to the counties because they have been able to claim TCM under the current regulations in the interim. This proposal would bring the money back in two payments, one in 2010 and one in 2011, to help the counties with cash flow issues that may happen around this.
Are there questions about this page? Let's move on then.
Madam Chair, the next page on page 45 makes... proposes four changes to the group residential housing program. The first change is to capture additional, we believe, additional federal reimbursement for the services that are provided to residents of group residential housing by amending the DD waiver to allow us to get more federal reimbursement on some of the services that are currently provided to people within the GRH settings. We believe that we can do this. This particular piece would not happen until the next biennium and would result in a savings of $1 million a year. Essentially, the services would be provided through the DD waiver instead of through GRH, so thus would be half federal money, half state money, instead of the current GRH program, which is 100% state general fund dollars.
So is this the waiver that's capped in the governor's budget?
Madam Chair, there are, I believe, limits on that waiver in the governor's budget. We believe that this would be additional reimbursement for people that are in the DD waiver. The estimate is not based on additional growth being allowed.
So... I guess I'm just having trouble linking up the DD waiver and the group residential housing program here.
Well, Madam Chair, many of the people who are served through GRH are developmentally disabled, and there are certain services that are reimbursed under the DD waiver. So we can't have now somebody whose room and board is paid through GRH, but whose services are paid in whole or in part through the DD waiver. But there are some folks who don't have all their services paid through the DD waiver or don't have any because of the way that waiver is structured. And we, in the past, have made some changes to try to progressively move as much of the service funding as we can onto the waiver because we get 50% FFP. This is an additional step that we think we can take based on our understanding of how the waiver works that would allow us to open that door somewhat wider.
So is everybody who's in group residential housing that's eligible for a waiver, does everyone have one?
Madam Chair, I'm going to have to get help with that one.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dwayne Elg. I'm with the Community Partnerships Division of the Department of Human Services. This particular proposal applies only to family adult foster care settings. The DD waiver has no service payment provision for family foster care. And so a DD client living in a family foster care home has their so-called supervised living services paid for by group residential housing difficulty of care payment, because that does pay for the foster care component. So what we would do is be to shift the family foster care payment to the DD waiver under the provisions of supervised living services, which is paid for by the DD waiver.
Okay, well, that makes it so much clearer.
I'm sure.
So I'll try to do the question over again. Does everybody who's in family foster care with developmental disabilities have a waiver?
Yes.
Okay. So they don't get placed in family foster care unless they've been allowed to be in a waiver slot?
Yes.
Okay. And how much savings is that again? This sheet again isn't very clear.
Madam Chair, it's $1 million a year in 12 and 13. Because of the time it would take us to make the adjustments to get the waiver change, it doesn't have any effect in this by coming biennium.
What do you have to do to get the waiver change?
Madam Chair, and Dwayne maybe will address this better than I. My understanding is it's both a matter of the, you know, getting the feds to change the waiver, but it's also a matter of changing the way that we deliver and oversee some of the services at the local level so that we can have it aligned correctly to fall under the waiver as opposed to being a GRH kind of expenditure. And there's some work involved for that for our continuing care staff in order to do that. And given the other pieces they have layered in front of it in this area, this was the timing that they thought they could get to moving forward with this proposal.
So it isn't because you think it'll take 2 years to get a waiver request?
Madam Chair, that's not my understanding, no.
It's because we have this service delivered at the county level and it's going to take us that long to get the counties to change it over?
Madam Chair, that's correct. I'd ask Mr. Elg if he has anything to add to that.
Madam Chair, I don't have anything to add.
Well, I don't understand why it would take that long for the county. I mean, I realize that this would be some changes for them, but it would seem to me that we would be able to be more nimble than that.
Madam Chair, I think it really was partly a workload issue for our state staff who are going to be making, it, under the governor's budget, a number of other changes that are going to require more immediate attention.
Well, of course, these pages should stand on their own. I mean, we're not obliged to adopt the governor's budget in total. And so we make decisions page by page. So if we don't do something else, then it affects this.
Madam Chair, I think that this we want this proposal to stand as it is, with the timing being into the next biennium.
Well, I understand that. That's the way you're presenting it. But I think it's fair for us to ask questions about whether, if there are savings here, it could be done quicker.
Madam Chair, and we can get back to you with a better explanation of exactly what it is that requires the 2 years to get to the point where we're implementing this.
So aside from taking some things that are paid for through family foster care now and putting it into the DD waiver, what else does this page do?
Madam Chair, the second change on this page relates to getting additional reimbursement through the food stamp program to support our GRH program. You may recall that several years ago, we pursued a waiver with USDA around the food stamp program to get reimbursement for essentially the board or food costs of the people in GRH facilities on the basis that these are people who are eligible for food stamps and we should get payment for them. At that time, the waiver that we got was for facilities that were nonprofit. And we thought under the way we were approaching the waiver that that was all that USDA had the authority to do. They actually gave us the waiver under a different part of federal law, which to us looks broader, and we therefore believe we can get this waiver and thus get the revenue for food stamps across the for-profit part of the GRH program as well, which will result in federal reimbursement offsetting of state general fund in the amount of about $14.4 million for the biennium.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solin?
I still have a few questions about the DD waiver.
Oh, that's fine. Okay. I just thought I'd let him finish the page.
Assistant Commissioner Johnson, am I to understand that we are reducing the number of increases in DD waivers or reducing the number of DD waivers?
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solin, my understanding is there's proposed a cap on the growth in the DD waiver.
But you hope to capture more of a federal match on the waivers that we
more,
have.
More of a Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solin, more of a federal match on the DD waiver for some of the current DD waiver individuals.
Okay, and Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner Johnson, does it require a change in placement for these individuals or just paperwork changes?
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solin, there shouldn't be any impact on the people here. This is really about just changing how we pay for the services to be able to capture more federal reimbursement.
Okay.
All right, I understand there's more to this page. So
Madam Chair, there
going.
Is more to this page. There are also two changes two pieces of the personal needs allowance and the community living adjustment. Under current law, there are two different levels of personal needs allowance in the program. For those GRH individuals who have an MSA SSI basis of eligibility, they have a personal needs allowance of $109 a month. For those individuals with a GA basis of eligibility, they have an $89 a month personal needs allowance. This proposal would align those both at the $89 level, resulting in savings to the general fund of, I have it combined with the other one. Between this and the next one I'm going to talk about, it's about $7 million for the biennium. The second piece of this is in 2005, I believe, there was created something called a community living adjustment, which is a $12 payment that at the time was intended to offset expected costs in changes in the pharmacy system. Medicare Part D came along and essentially made this for Medicare recipients not really necessary. but it still exists in law. And so this community living adjustment, which is sort of another form of personal needs allowance of $12 a month, we are also proposing to eliminate that. So that, along with the change of the personal needs allowance, results in about $7 million in savings for the biennium within the GRH program.
Assistant Commissioner, are not some of these people still receiving some of their drugs through the Medicaid program?
Madam Chair, that would be correct. Those who are not Medicare eligible, which would generally be those with a GA basis of eligibility.
And so how many of those people would there be that would be affected by this?
Madam Chair, approximately 5,000.
And I believe that we changed the, we capped the copayment for pharmacy in the Medicaid program to $7 a month.
Madam Chair, that sounds right to me, but I'm not the expert on that.
Well, I'm having a hard time exactly understanding why this whole page is in your division to start with, honestly. It doesn't seem like much of any of it has much to do with children and economic assistance grants.
Madam Chair, the infrastructure that supports the GRH program, the MAXIS system training and so forth, are in my area. And so it's an alignment around those pieces of how we run the program, as you're suggesting, not so much around sort of the policy and population.
Well, so is the net impact of this that 5,000 people will no longer be getting, having a cap on their medical assistance copayments based on where they live?
Madam Chair, the effect is, I believe, would be that they would no longer have the $12 offset to offset that cost of the copay that they have for their pharmacy.
But they would still have
still
the $7
have the
cap so that their prescription drugs that come to them through Medicaid would no longer cost more than $7.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if we're ready to move on, the next page, on page 47.
No, I wanted to see if there were any more questions about this page. Okay, I guess not. Let's go on then.
Madam Chair, page 47 has reductions to the child care assistance program for the purposes of meeting the general fund deficit. This proposal includes two changes to the child care assistance program. The first is to reduce the rates that we pay to child care assistance providers by 3%, effective July 1 of 2009. Currently, rates are were frozen in 2003 and have been increased in a couple of increments by the legislature in proactive moves since then, 1.75% in 2006 and 6% in 2007. This would reduce those rates across the board by 3% for all types of providers. That results in a savings of $9.4 million for the 10-11 biennium. This proposal would also increase the copays that participants have. Currently, families receiving the child care assistance program pay a copay that is progressive based on their income, so it's a percent of their income that goes up gradually as their income goes up. This would increase that by 3%. That means for someone who has a $100 copay, their copay would become $103 a month. That results in savings of just under $1,972,000 for the biennium.
So I think we'd like to get what the new copayment schedule would look like.
Madam Chair, we have that, and we can provide that to the committee.
So much for people sitting around their kitchen table, huh? Are there any questions on this page? Move on then.
Madam Chair, the next several pages include changes to the Minnesota Family Investment Program. The first page that you're looking at on page 49 has bunched together several changes to the Minnesota Family Investment Program. All of these are changes that would result in savings of TANF dollars, and as you'll see later, the governor proposes then to refinance those TANF dollars for general fund savings. The first change is to reinstitute a policy that was in effect from 2003 to 2007 that requires participants who are in post-secondary education to also be working 20 hours a week. That results in a savings of about $1.1 million for the 10-11 biennium. The second change relates to individuals who are on MFIP who are receiving, who are also in subsidized housing. Under current law, someone who is in subsidized housing and receiving MFIP, we count $50 of their subsidized housing essentially against their MFIP grant. This proposal would increase that $50 to $100, which produces a savings of about $3.1 million for the biennium. This change would be effective February 1st of 2010. The third change that's on this page is reinstituting a policy that was in effect from 2003 to 2007. It was repealed in 2007. This impacts families who are receiving SSI and also receiving MFIP. We would count $125 per person per SSI recipient against the MFIP grant. This proposal would be effective March 1st of 10 and result in savings of $13.2 million for the 10-11 biennium. The last change is also a reinstitution. In 2007, the asset limit for vehicles was increased from $7,500 to $15,000. This proposal would move that asset limit back to $7,500. That results in a savings. That's also effective March 1st of 10. That results in a savings of $365,000 for the biennium. There are also systems costs related to this proposal of $36,000 in 2010.
So I guess the question is that if you weren't trying to refinance this, would you be making these policy recommendation changes?
Madam Chair, the vehicle asset and the 20-hour work requirement were issues that I think had some policy importance. Governor objected to the vehicle asset limit when it was passed in 2007, and the 20-hour work requirement was something that he had proposed and advocated for in 2003. The other two changes are targeted to align to families who have additional benefits beyond the MFIP grant and to avoid making reductions to other MFIP individuals. They are more because we are facing a budget deficit and we need to be looking at all avenues for how we address the $4 billion deficit.
Well, I think it's fair to say that all of these things were agreements that were made in various budget years with the administration. And I don't notice any of the other sides of the agreements being taken off the table.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
What strikes me is that the goals seem oxymorons to the actions that are being recommended in this budget. I mean, the goal here is all Minnesotans will have the economic means to maintain a reasonable standard of living, but we're cutting the opportunities for those same individuals to be able to achieve that goal.
And fewer people in the program will have automobiles to look for or to secure jobs. Are there any other questions on this page? Let's move on then.
Madam Chair, page 50. This proposal addresses the work participation benefit. This proposal was passed in 2007. Excuse me. Under current law, it provides a benefit, cash benefit, to families of $75 for up to 24 months after they leave MFIP program. This is intended to and will help us with our work participation rate by allowing us to count those working families, the ones that have actually been successful in the program. We can't count under the way the feds currently structure the work participation rate. It would allow us to count them in the work participation rate for up to 24 months after they leave assistance. This proposal, this has not been implemented yet. It will be implemented October 1st of 2009. This proposal would drop that $75 benefit to $50. We believe that at $50, that threshold, we continue to get the same work participation benefit, that is the increase we get for the work participation benefit, but it does provide some savings and doesn't affect anyone currently on the program because the program has not yet been implemented.
Are there questions about this page? Okay. Let's move on then.
Chair, the next page, page 51. This proposal would decrease the exit level for the MFIT program from 115% of the poverty level to 110% of the poverty level. Under current law, a family can earn up to 115% of the poverty level, and that's the point at which they would lose eligibility for the MFIT program. This proposal would reduce that exit level to 110% of poverty, which impacts about 113 cases a year who would not be eligible for the program and produces the savings we see here on the page of just under $2 million for the biennium.
Well, again, it seems as if this recommendation does not exactly meet the key goal for the program. Are there questions about this page? Yes, I do have a question about all of the recommendations for TANF in general and how they affect our ability to be able to leverage any of the additional federal TANF funds that otherwise might be available to the state because of our economic situation.
Madam Chair, I don't believe that the changes that are proposed here would affect that. There would be some competition for maintenance of effort funding, which is an important part of the way the contingency fund is set up at the federal level, which may be the device they use for delivering additional funds to states. We would have to look at that more closely to know exactly how the pieces fit together. But the contingency fund will be a challenge for us to access funds through anyway because of the way that the maintenance of effort requirements are set up in that program.
I understand that. So in my opinion, we should probably be going the other way. We should be investing more in people who are in the TANF program. There should be more, instead of taking grants away from people, instead of taking exit level away from people, you know, instead of taking automobiles away from people, instead of taking ability to go to school away from people, instead of doing all of those things, we should be investing more to help people in the MFIP program to be more successful. And if we did so, we could pay for it with that additional money. Has there actually ever been a cost-benefit analysis by the department in that regard?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that I understand what the cost-benefit analysis would be looking at.
Well, that if we were investing more so that we could claim more maintenance of effort and get the contingency funds, what benefit there would be in regard to that versus the additional expenditures we would be making.
Madam Chair, the contingency fund is only available when your unemployment rate is particularly high. So
well,
you have to be investing more general fund at the same time in order to create more maintenance of effort.
Well, I understand
that
it's
the challenge of the budget.
It's only available when your unemployment is high. Our unemployment is high, and it seems as if we're in a situation where it's going to be high for a period of time here. And so at least during that period of time, would there be a benefit to doing more investment instead of less investment in order to be able to secure those funds?
Madam Chair, I think that for the level of additional maintenance of effort we need and the additional expected additional federal money we get, that probably would not be a very good cost benefit. But it would depend on how much other MOE we'd be able to point to and what the increment would be that we'd need to put us over the top for getting the contingency funds. Direct answer to your question is no, we have not done a cost benefit of exactly that question.
Well, I think you should.
Chair.
Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner. If you do get around to such a cost benefit analysis, I would also, you know, assume that we would have some success level in actually moving people from public assistance to work, and that then they would be a productive part of society again, and that would need to be included in that cost-benefit analysis as well. So, you know, hopefully if you get around to doing something like that, it would be interesting to see.
Well, I don't think the issue is if you get around to doing something like that. I think we're requesting you to do that.
Even Madam Chair, we can look at the contingency fund rules and see what it would take for Minnesota to get there and what the cost-benefit of that would be.
And then just back to page 51 for a minute here. You had said there would be 113 cases affected by changing the exit level. The budget page says 8,000 cases.
Madam Chair, yes, to clarify, 113 that would actually become ineligible due to the changes, 8,000 whose benefits would be affected because reducing the exit level reduces essentially the earned income disregard for any family who's working.
Thank you for that clarification. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner Johnson. When we're talking about a cost-benefit analysis and a couple of the comments you've made about, you know, the difficulties with the budget and difficult choices and everything needing to be on the table, it just kind of, to me, begs a much broader question. When we heard from the Department of Health, we heard that one of their goals was reducing healthcare disparities. Minnesota does not rank well when it comes to the disparities we have between different economic levels and their healthcare outcomes. And we've also know that we've seen growing economic disparities in the state in recent years. So I guess if we're looking at a broader analysis of cost-benefit, you know, we have one philosophy that seems to say that if we spend more money on the upper level of the of people in the economy, that somehow there's going to be a benefit that's going to trickle down to, I don't know if it's supposed to reduce these disparities or if it's just supposed to, you know, lift our GDP overall or what. But I guess, as opposed to a different direction that would say these kinds of programs, if we're giving our investments, putting our investments here, we're going to allow people to graduate from high school. We're going to allow people to stay healthy even if they're at the lower end of the economy in terms of their ability to pay for health care, and that's going to have an overall benefit for our economy. I'd be interested I would really be interested in a serious analysis of that, those differences in approach, because it seems to me that the direction we're going is going to increase those health care and economic disparities rather than closing that gap.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, you're asking what I think is really a macroeconomic question about what is the best way to stimulate the economy and to address, and what is the best way to address some of the disparities that we have existing now in Minnesota. I'm not sure that I'm in a very good position to answer the first one with any expertise. I think the stimulus package that's being talked about at the federal level certainly has money that would be driven to people who are unemployed and so forth to go exactly to the issue that you're talking about, as well as money directed to the states that seems to be intended to give us a cushion so we don't have to cut as deep in some of these programs. As far as the disparities go, I would speak more to the racial ethnic disparities. That is where it's going to continue on our part, regardless of what the outcome of these budget pages are. And it's work that we're engaged very closely with the counties on, and how we work with those communities to ensure that we're providing services that are culturally competent and effective for the kids and families in those groups.
You know, just for additional thought in regard to this conversation, there was an economic analysis of the pieces in the stimulus package that's being discussed at the federal level, and the economist said the first thing that would have a direct impact would be the increase in food stamps, because that money would be spent immediately and would begin circulating in our economy. And I think, you know, what Senator Olson's comments are regarding is that these monies that are being taken out of MFIP families' budgets are monies that are being directly spent today supporting our economy. And when they're gone, they're going to be direct, there will be a direct impact on those communities of having less spending. And, you know, especially since these monies are given to us by the federal government to be spent on these families, it does seem as if it's really unfortunate that we have these budget pages before us. Any other questions? I think we're up to page 53 now.
Madam Chair, I believe 52.
52. Thank you.
Madam Chair, this page would eliminate a grant that was created in 2007. This was a grant for integrated services projects. In 2005, the department initiated with 8 counties integrated services, or 8 sites, I should say, integrated services projects, really designed to bring together services across the human services system to focus on those families that had multiple challenges, families on MFIP that had multiple challenges. That was intended to be a time-limited grant that the department had created. We were looking at whether these could become self-sustaining kinds of initiatives at the local and county level. And we have now an evaluation of those projects, which saw mixed success across the 8 projects that were run. The legislature provided money in 2007. These are also TANF dollars to support these projects. This proposal would eliminate that funding. Because contracts run through the calendar year, it's half the savings in the first year and then the full savings going out into the future.
Other questions? Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, the background information indicates that there were some positive outcomes. It also says that there were some mixed results. I don't remember seeing an evaluation or a report of these dollars, but I would feel more comfortable in having a little bit better data before making a decision on this in this particular area.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, that evaluation was done by the Urban Institute out of Washington. It's just been finalized and released publicly, so we can share that with the committee.
Yes, we'd like to get a copy. Any other questions? Okay, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, page 53. Affects the MFIP Consolidated Fund. This is the fund that we use to support the work that counties do to support the MFIP program. They use this to pay for the employment services and other services, including offsetting some of the cost of eligibility workers and to provide emergency needs to families and children in their communities. This proposal would reduce the Consolidated Fund by 5%. 5%, when the Consolidated Fund was set up in 2003, it was set up so that 5% of the allocation of the funds to counties would be based on their performance. That method persisted through 2007. In 2007, the law was amended so that while there continues to be performance language in law, essentially any county that submits a program improvement plan continues to get the full extent of their allocation, and no longer is the 5% really paid to the county based on how they perform. As a result, and because of the budget pressures we're facing, we're proposing to phase out the performance piece of the consolidated fund, which amounts in the dollar amounts that you see on the page here.
And so what part of this fund is used for emergency assistance?
Madam Chair, I don't believe I have the breakdown with me. My memory is it's around a quarter, and the total pot is about $114 million.
I couldn't hear you.
$114 million is the total size of the consolidated fund annually, and I believe that about a quarter goes to emergency needs. We can get a detailed breakout of where the dollars go.
I would think at this particular time there would be more need for emergency assistance than ever, especially with the home foreclosure situation and, you know, utilities going up. Doesn't seem to me like it'd be a very good time to be cutting funds that would be used for emergency assistance. Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner Johnson, are these emergency assistance funds that would have been otherwise available or would be able to be used to pay for fuel assistance or to augment fuel assistance programs if someone, say, for example, is potentially going to have to move out of their house because they can no longer afford to heat it? Because I know with the weather we've had this winter, combined with electricity rates, that's becoming a real issue for people back in my district.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, yes, this is money that can be used for people who may not get energy assistance because that is a capped and limited amount, or people who may not get enough energy assistance to cover the total need that they have. This is money the counties can make available to those families to help offset the utility costs.
You might say this page is part of the ending homelessness project that the governor's working on. Any other questions? Okay, let's do the next page.
Madam Chair, page 54 is the page that does the TANF refinancing. On the previous pages that we've reviewed, we produced about $35 million in savings from the TANF account. This page takes the TANF money and reappropriates it to the Child Care Assistance Program, reduces the general fund appropriation in the Child Assistance Program by a like amount, which produces the general fund savings that are associated with the MFIP changes and the grant changes we just talked about.
Are there any questions about this page? It's a good thing you have to add it all up, isn't it? Let's go on.
Madam Chair, page 55 is a technical page, but it has budget impact. This corrects base level adjustment errors that were made in the riders, appropriation rider last year. There were four programs where there were errors in the way the rider was written, and those total $189,000 in the first year and $199,000 in the second year of additional cost.
Other questions about this page? Not, let's go on.
Madam Chair, page 56 eliminates two grants in the Children Family Service area. These are both grants that were made in the 2007 legislature. One was made through the GRH funding structure to a particular program that provides lodging and care to people with mental illness, many of them homeless. The second is a grant that was provided using TANF money to a program that serves young parents, teen parents. And while these are certainly good programs, they're narrowly targeted programs, and they're targeted at particular agencies, and we're proposing that they be eliminated.
mental health portion of the grants. Was this part of the mental health initiative?
Madam Chair, I don't believe so. This was an appropriation that's made to People, Inc.
Oh, well, it's always a good program to cut, isn't it? Any other questions about this page? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, just a comment, Assistant Commissioner. I think that while you note that the program is narrowly focused, I would argue that that was probably by design, because there are often desires and intent to have things be more broadly based. In fact, to have things, good things that we know, best practices happen statewide. But we have been put in, often in position where, in order to get something started, that we've had to narrow our focus. And so I just want to point out that because something was narrowly focused or is very targeted, doesn't mean that it's not warranted or that it's not successful or that it wasn't, frankly, the legislature's desire to have that happen on a larger basis.
And there are times when we have very few programs that serve people with dual disabilities, such as people who are deaf and mentally ill. And so sometimes we just can't do those programs in every county across the state, but there are still people from a lot of places that go and get services from a program that provides that type of assistance when it's needed and it's not available elsewhere. Well, let's go on.
Madam Chair, page 57 is a federal compliance page. Congress in 2002 passed the Improper Payments Information Act. This is an act that the federal government uses to review programs that they believe are vulnerable to potential improper payments. And when they identify such a program, they create a regulatory scheme around which they require states to review the programs in accordance with certain regulations for improper payments and put in place procedures to ensure that we aren't making improper payments going into the future. And so it's a kind of a review, what's your error rate, pay back whatever we've paid improperly, and then make changes in order to ensure that we're not repeating our mistakes going into the future. They have determined now that the Child Care Development Fund will be under the Improper Payment Act. This is going to require us to do case reviews of 276 cases and to put in place corrective action procedures around that program going into the future. When we've had these kind of federal compliance that have come online in the past, we have always come here to ask for the staff to do that. That's what this page does, is asking for one FTE to do the Child Care Development Fund Improper Payment Act compliance work.
Any questions about this page? If not, let's move on.
Madam Chair, page 58 is the last page for Children and Family Services. This is a page that provides revenue through the Food Stamp Employment and Training Program. You may recall that 4 years ago, we created the ability to tap the Food Stamp Employment and Training Program to reimburse us for some of the costs within the MFIT program, because when we create state set-aside programs and non-MOE programs, they're sort of outside of the TANF realm, and we can treat them as if they're eligible for food stamp employment and training. Therefore, we're allowed to collect the 50% reimbursement the federal government provides. That authority was created 4 years ago, sunsets at the end of this fiscal year. This page does two things. It reinstates that authority so that we can keep collecting the $2.4 million a year that we have been under the existing authority. It also expands that authority to allow us to collect food stamp reimbursement on the child care that we pay for two-parent families in MFIP who are in a separate state program, which allows us then to increase that revenue to $3.37 million in the first year and $4.34 million ongoing.
Questions about this page? Okay. think you're done.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We'll make ourselves available as needed to discuss any of these, so please do feel free to call me or to call Ann Martineau if you want to talk about any of the items we put forward here.
So we have half an hour left, and we have two more parts of the budget to present, so I'll let you two decide who thinks they can finish in half an hour. So y'all don't have to keep coming back again.
Morning, Madam Chair, members. I'm Dennis Benson. I'm the executive director of the MSOP program. And we're here this morning to talk a little bit about our budget request. We've got some slides that we're going to show. We will refer to page numbers in the budget book, but we're going to try to provide a little context for the budget request. I think most of you know we have two sites, both at St. Peter and Moose Lake, where combined we have about 500 patients these days in the civilly committed sex offender program. We actually have a third site. We're renting from corrections 200 beds at the Moose Lake prison. So just to give you some background in terms of the population that we're talking about, the civilly committed sex offenders, a year ago, a decision was made to pull MSOP, Minnesota Sex Offender Program, out from under state-operated services. So creating some autonomy and making a little bit of a shift in terms of leadership of this entity. We've got a separate budget. We're developing different policy and procedure. After many years in a real growth spurt with this population, a decision was made that it really is not a healthcare program. I think we all agree with that. It is a civilly committed sex offender treatment program that requires lots of security and a very different kind of treatment modality than even I was used to when I spent my time with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. At the two facilities, we have them broken down into a number of different units. We have a 25-bed for those that have mental health issues, a 25-bed young adult unit, 25-bed for high psychopathy, a 25-bed unit for behavioral issue non-participants, and then another conventional treatment unit as well. We also have, as I mentioned, at the Moose Lake Annex, which is the prison, we have about 200 at that facility. And for the most part, they're either non-participants or they're involved in conventional programming. And then we also staff up a unit at the prison that's separate from the annex, that is kind of, they're still under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections, the Commissioner of Corrections, and it's a kind of a precursor to civil commitment. Those that look like they might be headed for civil commitment are involved in sex offender treatment at that facility. St. Peter, we have the Pexton and Chance buildings, which are behind Razor Ribbon now, 7, 28 to 36 bed units. We manage the holds and admissions down there, conventional programming, alternative program, which would be the lower functioning patients, assisted living unit, those that are getting old and needing a higher level of medical care, and then the supervised integration, those that have probably completed primary or conventional treatment and are a step away from being considered for community preparation service. Today we have one in community preparation service. We have another that has been affirmatively recommended by the SRB, Special Review Board, and we're waiting for that final determination from SCAP. We hope to hear any day now. We're going to mention our deficiency request, although we're here to talk primarily about our budget request for the next biennium. I've talked to several of you about the deficiency budget that we have run this biennium. I think it's important that you have some background, that those bills have been introduced. We will be appearing before the House Committee, I believe, Monday to talk about our deficiency request. A year ago, April, it was determined that we were on a trajectory to run about a $25 million deficiency in the MSOP budget. We've worked hard the last 11 months. I came on board in March. We've done a variety of different things to try to bring this deficiency down, primarily by holding positions open. We're running MSOP today with about 150 fewer staff than we were a year ago. We have about 90 additional patients, so we're working hard to do more with less with respect to our population. We've reduced overtime pretty dramatically. We've gone to centralized scheduling. We've changed schedules. We've worked with labor to train folks in terms of managing this population a little bit differently than historically has been the case. We've reduced administrative costs, where our administrative team now is about $340,000 cheaper than it was a year ago. One-time costs, contract costs, purchasing a new budget situation. But the primary drivers of our deficit are really hooked to the building project at Moose Lake. Most of you know that we have a 400-bed facility that's under construction. That facility was scheduled to come online this past fall. It did not. When we came on board, they told us that it was not going to be ready until next fall, the fall of 2009. We've assigned a project manager to that project to work with Department of Administration. It's now scheduled to come on April 30th. We hope to be out of the rent-a-bed business. We're renting beds from corrections to accommodate our growth until we can get into this building. So that resulted in about $5 million, I believe, of that deficit. And in 2005, when SOS was involved in their budget request, they were under the impression that the new building would come on this past fall, and with the new building would come a savings of about $7 million. So those are the two primary drivers of the deficiency, the construction delay and the savings that was not realized because of the new building. We've done some other things to try to bring that number down. We have held lots of positions open. In addition to inside of that 150 staff, there's about 25 supervisors and managers. A lot of line staff positions have not been filled, and we have managed this through attrition. We have not, aside from a couple of managers, we have not laid anybody off at this point. We'd like to try to get to the new building, which we hope to be in July 1, which will give us some more tools in terms of efficiencies, sight lines, and then get down to that budget number that makes sense to us. The other area where we've saved a fair amount of money is food. When I was in corrections, we fed offenders on $3.29 a day. Again, because it was a hospital setting, especially at the Moose Lake facility, food costs were very, very high. We've gone to a different serving formula down there, not only for us, but I think the hospital as well, and we've cut those food costs in half. So we've been working hard to be good stewards of the budget here, and again, trying to reduce this deficiency request.
Executive Director Benson, I'd just like to disagree with you. We have calculated that about $6 million of your overspending would be due to not having the new building come online. That leaves about what you have left, about $9 million, which appears to me, at least, to be deliberate overspending of the budget this biennium.
Well, Madam Chair and members, again, we're... we were funded to rent beds until October, I believe, or November. Obviously, we're still renting beds. That bill is $660,000 a month that we're paying corrections for those two units. We will have to continue to pay that $660,000 until we get into the new building. So that is, I think, about $5 million. In 2005, I wasn't here. I came last March, but it's my
I'm not blaming you personally.
No, I understand that, Madam Chair. But the information we get from the finance director is that the growth request was reduced by $7 million, $7.1 million is the number that we got because they thought they would be in the new building last fall. So again, those two numbers are about $12 million. There's no question that lots of staff were hired, but I think we have to remember that MSOP went through a very difficult time with two escapes, very high visibility, lots of public safety issues. They moved the problematic patients from St. Peter up to the two prison buildings. That staff had no idea what would work in terms of staffing that population at that time. There was also about 50% that were not involved in treatment. Today, that number is up to about 80%. They started to make lots of programmatic changes 2, 3, 4 years ago, long before I came. Got an Office of Special Investigations, started monitoring phone calls, took away computers. I think most of you heard that somebody, one of the staff, an executive staff at St. Peter, was savagely beaten in his home at the hands of somebody in this program. So there was lots of concern about staff safety back in those days. So they did staff up the Moose Lake prison buildings to a level that now that we have some experience under our belt, we've been able to pull that back pretty substantially. But I'm not making excuses.
Executive Director Benson, if that was necessary, if additional spending was necessary, wouldn't it have been appropriate to bring change pages into the budget during the interim year, last session? Rather than to be overspending and come for a deficiency.
Madam Chair, I think we can sit here today and suggest that we should have done lots of things different a year ago. Again, I'm not making excuses. I wasn't here. When I got here, we figured out what the budget deficit was looking like, and that was in April that I understood what this budget picture was looking like, and we have done everything we can. Obviously, if we had it to do over again, I think we would do some things differently. I'm just simply here trying to state the facts, justify it to the extent that we can. There may have been some mistakes made, but again, looking at the history of this program, the complexity of this population, the acting out that had occurred with this population, I believe that the executive staff made a decision that if we're going to err, we're going to err on the side of staff safety and public safety. And the good news is we haven't had any escapes since the high visibility escape that I sat in on those painful hearings about 2, 3 years ago, too. We were a part of that. Corrections started to consult with MSOP back in those days. We borrowed them staff. We started to look at technology, at fences, at cameras, at redesign of facilities, and have done what we can to be good partners when I was wearing the corrections hat. And I think this program has come a long ways. I think the good news is we are on track. We're going to bring these costs down. We've got a plan to do that. And as we get into our budget pages here, Madam Chair, I hope that you'll see some signs that we've turned some corners here with respect to not only managing a difficult recalcitrant population that's very challenging, but also doing it efficiently and effectively.
Executive Director Benson, I'd like to just commend you for what you have done. And I would like to just correct something you said, at least from my side of the table, I believe. You have done what you were allowed to do. I believe there is more that you could do. And, you know, if it takes me on this side of the table to make that happen, then I can be the one that is blamed. But I believe we need to do more here.
Madam Chair and members, I would agree that now that we have some experience, that we're 6 months away from a new building with sight lines that are conducive to managing this population more efficiently, I believe there is more that we can do moving forward. And again, we have a plan that will get us there. And again, I think it's going to put this program in line with those costs that you see nationally. We're not going to stick out. I think that the other thing that's very encouraging is we're seeing a lot more program participation. As I mentioned, we have one person at CPS. You've got to have one before two. CPS is Community Preparation Service Program. He's been there about a year, a little less than a year, I believe. And we're on the precipice of number two. We've got a third that our clinical staff are telling us has met program goals, has a good plan and relapse prevention plan in place, and we're cautiously optimistic that the special review board will at least give him fair consideration for placement as well. So the wheels are starting to turn here in terms of this program working the way that I think we all had hoped it would someday, moving some people through. There are some that will never get out, but there are a few that probably should get out. And I just think that now that we've started to stabilize the program, got costs under control, we've got a new building coming online, I think there is great hope looking forward in terms of some policy issues that can help us manage this population that's growing at an unprecedented rate. That brings us to our budget page. This is page 147, actually 139 and 147 in the budget book. Start with actually, we're going to skip 139 for now. This is with respect to the corrections early retirement piece. Let's go to 146 and 147. And this is basically the bulk of our budget request. We're asking for 5.67 in fiscal year 10 and 8.33 in fiscal year 11. And just to break this down so that you understand what we're buying here, the growth, we're projecting growth at each additional patient that comes into the system at $150 a day. That's what we refer to for years in corrections as a marginal per diem. So we think we can add people to the program here at a cost of about $150 a day. Might be a touch over, might be a touch less. So that comes to 1.97 in 10 and 6.03 in 11. The numbers, we'll get to the numbers in a moment. Mr. Storkamp will go over that with you, talking about our projections and our bed space. The base budget, as you recall, Madam Chair and members, our base tails were cut a year ago by 2.3 a year. We think we're going to have trouble absorbing that cut. Again, we've held 150 positions open to get us down to That's 62 point some million dollars as a base budget. We're probably going to have to drop about another 60 positions between now and the end of the year. If we go beyond July 1, then we're going to need about 1.4 to manage this through attrition, which has been the method which we've tried to manage our cuts in MSOP. So those numbers add up to about $14 million. That's offset, I believe, by 1.4 that we bring in, but the general fund request is a little bit less than $14 million. But, and then the last item there, the early retirement change, if on page 139 of your budget book, MSOP's piece of that, if this would be implemented, it concerns about 155 staff in our program. Now, there's also staff in MSH and there's staff in corrections. This notion originated in corrections. It's in the governor's budget. Conceptually, we support it. Basically, what it does is takes everybody out of early retirement except those that are in uniform. So I'm sure that this will get lots of discussion through the session. I'm sure it'll be heard in pensions as well. It would concern school teachers, maintenance folks, our treatment staff who are in early retirement, nurses, and others who have been added to the corrections early retirement plan since the early 70s. It started with just correctional staff and special teachers, and it's expanded over time. It's a costly program. It's a different kind of retirement than folks like me and others get in terms of general retirement. On the other hand, the logic behind it many, many years ago was these folks have tough jobs. They don't live quite as long as everybody else. So with corrections, early retirement becomes the comes the opportunity to retire at age 55. So that's and paid health care upon retirement. The rest of us work till either rule of 90 or 65, or we get take a penalty when we retire, and we don't get paid health care. So in a nutshell, those are some of the differences.
Like the Executive Director Benson, before we leave the page 146, you indicated that the request for the increasing population would be $150 per day, but we have generally in the past operated this program on a per patient, per day, per diem. And so what do we, how should we be thinking of the existing patients that are not contributing to the growth in terms of the cost per person per day?
Madam Chair and members, that's a good question, and we, Mr. Storkamp and I and our budget director had this discussion here just a few weeks ago. Once we can add them for $150 a day because the infrastructure is there, once they get there, they become part of the big pool that costs about, I believe, the stated per diem this year is $345 a day. But again, adding these people at $150 a day is going to bring that average down pretty substantially as our population grows. Good news is our per diem will go down. The bad news is our total budget will continue to increase. But this slide gives you an idea of where we were a year ago. The stated per diem was $368 a day. This past July, we calculated it at $348 a day. This coming July, when we're in the new building, we believe because we're starting to add people now at $150 a day, it'll go down to just over $300. And then as we get that new building full, it should be down to about $285. And when we get the second building full, we think that per diem is going to be, in today's dollars, down to around $250. you can see what other states. Now, again, I always caution people that when you start talking per diem, everybody does it a little bit differently. But I can assure you that having worked in corrections where we only included operational costs and per diems, DHS includes everything. I mean, this is a full boat per diem, so it it's not understated in no uncertain terms. And it's the per diem is statutorily driven, I believe, in terms of how we have to state it, because there obviously counties have some skin in this game too, in that we bill them back. So, you know, again, the good news is I think it's going to go down. I'm confident it's going to go down as we get into new buildings with right-sized staffing, start to move some people through. But again, that growth factor, at least for the foreseeable future, is still there. The other thing, if you look at what the other states are doing, our neighbors to the east, which we pay some attention to, we've had a fair amount of contact with Sand Ridge. I'm happy to say several of you have gone with us. I think we've all learned a lot from that program. We're going to be very, very close to them in terms of per diem.
Executive Director Benson, it was nice that you went with us. So in 2006, which was, you know, the last time we have numbers for when we funded this program based on a per diem rate, we were paying $281 a day. So by 2008, somehow we've gotten to 368, is it up there?
Madam Chair, again, I wasn't here. We can do some research and historically give you those numbers. That might make some sense, because that was probably the time that the population was taking off. And
right, but you're telling us now that as the population takes off, the cost per person per day goes down.
The cost per person, the marginal per diem, the money that we're asking for. If we go to the projection slide, you'll see that in 2009, this year, we're projecting 73 will come into the program. Now, we average that number, because they're not all coming. They all didn't come in July 1. They come in at a staggered rate throughout the year. This is the way that we used to do it in corrections. We've worked with Jim King very closely on this formula to try to not only properly and adequately fund us, but not overfund us either. So we average this cost over the course of the year. And again, the number we come up with is 150. Understand that every 25 new folks that we get into the program, we have to add treatment staff to provide the kind of treatment that we think is going to make a difference in this program. And it's a pretty standard formula, too. Again, as we look at what the Sand Ridge program offered in other programs, it's pretty close. But in answer to your question, we can go back and historically match the population with the per diem so that you can track that retrospectively.
Well, we are very concerned not only about the growth of the population, which we understand you don't really have any control over, but the growth of the per person per diem, which we think you do have some control over.
I absolutely agree. That's very fair. And we look forward to being held accountable for that per diem. We're trying to make this program as transparent as we can. We actually brought media into Moose Lake a year ago. We have met with county attorneys on two different occasions. We've got another meeting scheduled. We're going to be meeting with the bench. There's a lot of interest in this program, as there should be. And again, I'm cautiously optimistic. I believe that we have learned so much the last 5 years with respect to this population. I also think that for the first time in modern history, we have a clinical team that has almost 100 years of clinical experience working with sex offenders. Not just PhDs, not just doctors, but we have clinical staff now that have years and years and years of working with sex offenders. We hired away from Sandridge, David Prescott, who is very well published, is the president of National ATSA. We hired Janine Hebert, who is here today, away from corrections, who has almost 20 years of working with sex offenders, and she grew up in that world, starting at the bottom, running groups in the community and working in outpatient and then working in the prison system and learning how to manage and managing other sex offender therapists. So she has a great background in this work, and she's president of Minnesota ATSA. So we have some very qualified people. We've got a couple slides left that I think we can finish here, if you can give us a couple more minutes.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, I'm Dan Starkamp, the Deputy Director of NSOP. Very quickly, because I know we're running short of time, the Minnesota sex offender population has dramatically increased since 2003, which was our tragic case that occurred here in Minnesota, and the system responding to that. We look at the population and historically and project into the future. We base it on current trends, current practice, and current practices, trends, and laws as they currently exist. The population projections are showing approximately 70 to 80 increase over the next several years, and this is what the budget was based on, and as Executive Director Dennis Benson talked about, this is the driving force behind the budget request for the growth moving forward. What the next slide shows are those population numbers based on line. And then we put bars where those populations are currently being held or we're anticipating them being held. The black bars in the bottom are our two facilities at Moose Lake and at St. Peter. We have approximately 180 at St. Peter and 320 at Moose Lake presently. The white bars are our annex, and we've got approximately 200 individuals being rented out at the annex at this time. At the Department of Corrections prison site. Again, we're renting those beds, and they've got to rent additionally, costing us basically twice for those beds. When the new building opens up in July, it will be 60% full, 55 to 60% full, because we'll be pulling everybody back from the annex and putting them into the new Phase 1 building. At that rate, and looking at the projected growth, that 400 beds will be full by late 2011. At which time we'd be looking for additional space again. And in the past, you've seen a budget or a bonding request for a second 400-plus ancillary services moving forward.
Madam Chair and members, that concludes our...
So just so we are clear, I believe that the changes that are being made in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program in terms of giving the citizens of the state of Minnesota better value for their dollar are exactly headed in the right direction. And I congratulate you for seeing that the changes are needed to be made. On the other hand, in regard to the spending, you have sat here and listened to what we have listened to for 2 days now. So you understand, I think, the kind of programs that this budget request is competing with. And it's for that reason that I must be very disciplined in my approach to your budget.
Madam Chair, we certainly respect the position that you and committee members are in with respect to this. I don't doubt that this is not anybody's favorite program. I would add, though, that it's critical to public safety in the state of Minnesota, and we also understand what can happen if we don't take this business very seriously. I know you do. You've been in the middle of that brouhaha as well. So we appreciate your support, and we look forward to working with the committee to make the wheel as round as we can, not only programmatically, but from a budget perspective as well.
Other questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. This proposal is a 19% increase, and we spent most of our meeting today discussing ways in which it's being suggested that we are no longer able to support Minnesota families and getting families back to work and giving them that step up they need so that they can be successful and contribute to society and to our tax base. And so I think it's important just to point that out, to put this in the request in perspective. And Madam Chair, I hope that if through this division or other divisions, that we will continue to entertain discussions on the policy implications behind this. Because I think that's something that we do have some control over, and I encourage us to continue to work towards that end.
Well, that's why I'm trying to get down to figuring out exactly what our per diem rate is. And the slide you showed of Sand Ridge today is 281. We were paying in 2006 281. I understand that there would perhaps be some growth between 2006 and 2009 in terms of inflation, but I do not understand 345.
Madam Chair, just very quickly, I would, at the risk of sounding defensive, part of our struggle is three sites. We are managing populations at three different sites when you include the prison. Sandridge was a single site, had all of their infrastructure under one roof. And again, when we get to the new building, get out of the prison, we're going to drop pretty substantially. So I believe, again, we can't do it tomorrow responsibly, but we can bring these costs down over the course of time. I would also add that I agree with you, Senator Lynch, that it's a significant increase in the big picture. But what, as you mentioned, what we don't have control over is the number of people that come to us. We're the repository. We don't get to refute that. What we do have some control over, though, is moving people through, and I think we do have a responsibility to offer the best treatment available that are consistent with best practices, and I believe that we've got a significant change last year when it's courts in, now courts out. I think that's significant. I do believe that if they meet the terms of their treatment plan, that you will start to see some trickle back into the reintegration piece, which will also help the cost and will also lower the per diem. So
well,
again,
I think it's fair to say that the part of the executive branch that's in this division's budget does not have any control of the number of people being committed. But that is not to say that other parts of the executive branch don't. And, you know, it's three sites that we're managing because we have so much more growth than they have in Wisconsin in terms of their program. I don't hear anybody suggesting that the people in the state of Wisconsin are having their safety compromised because they have a smaller program than we have.
Madam Chair, I think there are also lots of productive and good discussions occurring with respect to policy, too. And I agree with you, Senator Lynch, that I think it's time to start to look at those policies, too, as I mentioned, where even the prosecutors of all folks are very interested in the numbers and the costs, and so is the bench. So I think the time is right to begin having those discussions that can also result in part of the solution to this unprecedented growth. I've said it before, I think you know it, that next to California, we have the largest civil commit population in America, and that's not per capita.
Okay, any other questions? If not, thank you. We'll be seeing you again.
Thank you.